like to welcome Commissioner Moore to the. And as with our last confirmation hearing members, we are proceeding along the same way. We developed some questions for Commissioner Moore. We provided those questions to Commissioner Moore in advance, and as well as to members. And we want to make sure that we are thorough and do our due diligence as a committee, because we're going to be working with Commissioner Moore over the next 4 years. We want to know where he's coming from, what his stances are on various issues, and how he plans to run the Pollution Control Agency. Although I don't foresee any particular concerns, I have had only good experiences with Commissioner Moore, as well as many others. We want to make sure that we, as a committee, do our due diligence, and as a body that is charged with providing advice and consent of the Senate, it's incumbent upon this committee to provide accurate advice and consent. So with that, to welcome Commissioner Moore, if you would like to start with an opening statement, we certainly can. At the very least, maybe you can just introduce yourself to the members and provide some background on yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for providing the time for this hearing. My name for the record is Brad Moore, and I'm the current commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. I think I'll get started with a very brief background and give you a sense of, you know, why I want to be a commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency and give you a sense. First of all, most of my career has been spent in the public sector, my professional career, time with the Department of Public Service, the regulatory arm of the Public Utilities Commission, and then a majority of the time with the Department of Natural Resources in various capacities, from analyst to assistant commissioner. I think during that time, that experience, what's developed is a keen appreciation for the role of public servants, and to do a good job in terms of to hold to the highest ethical standards in terms of when working in the public policy realm and working with citizens and also the legislature. So it just gives you a general sense. I have a passion for the environment and conservation. I remember as a child, I had three brothers and myself, and we'd tumble out of the backyard. There was a trout stream called Tisher Creek in Duluth, and we literally spent summers wading in that stream all the way up to Hartley Field, which is now a nature center, and then down to Lake Superior. Some of you might be aware of the Congdon Mansion in Duluth, which is now owned by the University of Minnesota. There's the bridge there. We used to, as boys, sneak under the bridge through the water during steelhead season and try to catch fish, and the caretaker would gently chase us off the grounds back up the river. And so, anyway, water and clean water and air and the environment have been a lifelong passion. In terms of the Pollution Control Agency specifically, I think the best way to characterize is my interest in that agency grew over time through my work at DNR. In the commissioner's office, there always needed to be someone who was a liaison between the DNR commissioner's office and the Pollution Control Agency. And usually I was ended up being that individual. And so when I'd come over for joint meetings, I started to develop an interest in the work of the PCA in addition to the DNR. And over time, I've grown to appreciate the role of PCA in our air, water, and land protection. And when the opportunity came last August, I thought it would be a good opportunity to lead this agency and further make a difference for Minnesotans with respect to the mission of MPCA. So that's a very brief overview of, you know, kind of how I got to where I am and some of my background in terms of employment and my deep interest in natural resources.
How would you describe your management style?
My management style, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my management style is one of collaboration. And let me give you several examples of what that really means. I recall a time at DNR when there was a lot of disagreement among several divisions related to forest policy, and conflicts came up to the commissioner's office, and we were always trying to resolve them. And in order, instead to constantly resolve differences of opinion, we thought, you know, let's bring folks together in terms of the different players from Ecological Services, Forestry Division, whatever. And I created a team of people and chaired that team in order for the various viewpoints to be shared and for the team to co-create the direction with respect to forest policy for DNR. And so even though I was a member of the commissioner's office, as that policy was created, I tried to work collaboratively with the various members in the department, all different levels. And as a consequence, I think in that example, I can't think of any issues of major disagreements in DNR over forest policy that have gotten out in the public realm like they used to maybe 7 to 10 years ago. So I like to collaborate in terms of involving staff members in the decision-making, in their viewpoints, whether they're scientists, policy people, or they have a different perspective than I might have. And I think I have a good track record in that area.
What maybe, I think most of the members know the answer to these some of these questions, but let's kind of start from the basics. Talk about what the agency is responsible for regulating, monitoring, and what's the current status of areas for which the agency is responsible.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll start off real basically. The agency is responsible for air quality in Minnesota, water quality, and that includes groundwater as well, and groundwater monitoring, and then land in with respect to contaminants, so that we can restore land that has been contaminated to desirable uses. So you think of air, water, and land at its most fundamental levels. If we begin with air quality, the good news with respect to criteria pollutants, that would be federal pollutants, such as sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, lead, volatile organic compounds, we're in attainment right now. So in other words, the work of the agency over the past 20 years has actually had the amount of air pollutants drop, and that we've actually have cleaner air today than we did several decades ago. The work that we're specifically focusing on now is to further reduce the air pollutants for several reasons. First of all, we all want cleaner air. But secondly, the standards in terms of air quality are getting more restrictive. In other words, as science moves forward, we find out that we need fewer and fewer air particulates to cause a problem, for example, in our lungs or heart. And so while we're in compliance with respect to particulate matter right now today, we run the risk of not being in compliance in the future and perhaps the near future. So my agency's responsibility with respect to air is to make sure we keep driving down in terms of the various kinds of air pollutants, whether it's sulfur dioxide. And you note the bill that this legislature just passed in terms of renewable energy, 25 by 25, 30% for Xcel Energy in terms of renewables. That's going to help a great deal in terms of reducing some of these pollutants. In air quality, doing a lot of focus on reducing particulate matters, some of the big pollutants like sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide. Examples where you'll see us in the coming years pushing hard on this include in northern Minnesota, regional haze. The federal government has standards for regional haze with respect to what's called Class 1 airsheds of Voisey's National Park and the Boundary Waters. And there's a goal by 2064 to get rid of that regional visibility haze where, for example, if you're a canoeist in the Boundary Waters, so you can see the cliffs in the distance or the view shed. We're working right now, for example, with the taconite companies to begin the work to be reducing emissions of nitrogen oxide at those facilities because they're a key component, as well as utilities such as Minnesota Power and other companies, Xcel Energy. So that'd be an example where we're actively engaged today in making our air cleaner for tomorrow. And that engagement involves working with those stakeholders, not only the utilities and the taconite companies themselves, but other state agencies such as the DNR, which is working on research, for example, at how to reduce mercury emissions from taconite facilities. So, Mr. Chairman, with respect to air, those are several examples of the work. Before I move on to a different medium, are there questions related to some of the work we're doing in air?
Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just in general to those points, are you structured to accomplish that work, or do you see restructuring in the near future, or are things in place to get the work done?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, from what I see right now, the structure looks pretty good in terms of being able to deal with these problems. And it's both a divisional structure, so for example, an industrial division that deals with large facilities, a remediation division that deals with Superfund. But in addition to those specific divisions, there's what we call a cross-media work, or media being air, so teams and members that come from all the different perspectives and will work on an air issue. I'm pleased to say in coming to the PCA is I haven't seen a lot of disagreement or fighting among one division versus another over turf or perspective, which suggests that the structure is working pretty well. An area I do want to look at is the general to make sure that we have enough high-level policy work that's in integrated fashion for the commissioner's office. But that's less a restructuring issue and more an issue of making sure we have the right people tapped to help us with a given issue at a given time.
Thank you. Please continue.
Well, another big area, as you know, is water. And water, in terms of the budget and the number of people, in terms of FTEs, is huge. And the Clean Water Legacy, this committee and the legislature has been very generous this past year. With respect to water quality, the agency is involved in several aspects. First of all, Clean Water Legacy and trying to maintain the quality of our surface waters where those waters are not impaired. And then, of course, where the water quality is impaired, to clean them up to water quality standards. This is going to be a major emphasis in the coming years for this administration. And it's a major challenge area because ultimately, once we have a TMDL, total maximum daily load, in place for a given watershed or a river, it really takes local stakeholders to implement that and that buy-in locally to make something happen. And that means good working relationships with the agriculture community, good working relationships with folks who run the wastewater treatment plants, relationships with urban centers in terms of stormwater runoff, et cetera. So to solve the riddle of impaired waters in Minnesota, our agency has to not only continue the traditions of collaboration, but we're actually going to have to enhance them and step it up to even a higher level than we have at present. Another area of water that's obviously very high on people's minds is groundwater. And one of the question was asked about restructuring. One thing that happened just this past December is that we created in our outcomes division a water section in terms of water monitoring. So the focus of that section manager is just focusing on water monitoring. And within that section is a groundwater unit as well, because we're realizing that we have to make sure to have adequate focus in these particular areas, whether it's dealing with emerging contaminants, much of you've read recently in the newspapers, but also all the interest in groundwater related to ethanol plants, mining facilities, potable drinking water. We realize we have to actually focus some time and people responsible for that. So that's a brief overview of water, but large area for the department, a focus for me as commissioner. It's obviously been a strong focus for this legislature and related, of course, to our budget initiatives as well.
Do you think that the Clean Water Legacy Act is adequately funded?
When you look at the, Mr. Chairman, whether the Clean Water Legacy Act is adequately funded, in the long term, we will need additional dollars to implement the goals of the Clean Water Legacy Act. In the short terms, in terms of our request that we have made for the Pollution Control Agency, I truly believe that is about the appropriate amount of money to request, and here's why. I think down the years we will need more money, but to get that amount of money in the agency, allocate that money to contracts, say, for a monitoring or TMDL development, it takes some time to set those contracts up, work with consultants or local units of government, and actually move the money through the agency out into the various places where it will be spent. And I have to demonstrate to you that I'm spending that appropriately. I'm concerned if we have a lot more money coming in this biennium than what we asked for. It's actually a level of money that's going to be difficult for us to manage thoughtfully given the resources and the ramping up that we are doing today. So, for example, because of the dollars you gave us the last session, we're better able to handle our proposed request. And similarly, in the future, by moving this money into the system, I think we'll have a more robust program for the future.
How will that ramping up proceed over the next year, 2 years, 5 years?
Mr. Chairman?
How many more lakes are we going to be able to assess for impairment and then move towards recommending remediation and then implementing remediation?
In terms of, Mr. Chairman, the budget request that we have, it would result in approximately 23 additional TMDLs, or those studies of watersheds, in terms of the next cycle. And the key on the TMDL is that once one of these studies has been done, and of course the study basically, what it does is figures out how much pollution can go into the water and meet water quality standards. And as a result, when a TMDL is completed, it means you have to tighten down the regulations on whether it's wastewater treatment plants, non-point pollution, what have you. As a consequence of getting those studies done, we'll then be able to take our restoration dollars, for example, next year's bonding session, and then put those dollars towards the areas that we know can actually clean up those impaired waters. And so the reason you see our budget request structured heavily on the TMDL side is because that will direct future dollars. Without those TMDLs, if we get a bunch of dollars coming in, say, for restoration, we're not as able to ensure that they're going to be spent in the appropriate place. So, Mr. Chair, first of all, in terms of the next few years, emphasis on TMDLs, so that we take that monitoring data, actually decide where you're going to reduce pollutants, and then so actually then we can implement restoration methods. In terms of staffing, we have not determined the total additional staffing, but our goal, and so far it's been pretty good, is try to move as much of those dollars out to regionally and local uses. So it might be a TMDL study done by the University of St. Cloud. The MPCA tends to hang on to the work where we have a particularly complex study or TMDL to be done. And a good example of that is the Lake Pepin TMDL, where we're very engaged in that in terms of oversight and our scientists. But again, we're partnering with the University of Minnesota and other entities because that one is so large.
What areas of clean water legacies implementation could be improved upon?
Mr. Chairman, I think one of the areas where we can improve is figuring out how to do the TMDLs more efficiently. We've already done a better job than a few years ago, but we believe that we can get some efficiencies as we learn more about them, so that if there's some standard science behind it, rather than reinvent the wheel, we can use some of what we learned in one TMDL to work on other TMDLs as well. So that's one area. And then the other is to just look for efficiencies in terms of working with local partners, so that we don't go into a watershed and do a study on one particular pollutant and have to come back 2 years later and study a different one. So instead, stacking up those TMDLs and really do a good job on a particular stretch of river or watershed would be one example that comes to my mind.
Wouldn't we benefit by doing more TMDLs annually?
Mr. Chairman, yes. And in fact, our particular budget initiative does move us in a direction of additional TMDLs.
Last question, I'll call on some people. Are you concerned at all that our impairment testing doesn't necessarily include testing for all pollutants, for example, endocrine disruptors, perfluorochemicals, and even if there is, even amongst the common list of pollutants that we test for, we don't, there, and this was testimony we heard earlier this session, we don't necessarily test for all of those in one particular TMDL.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the challenge for us is that there probably are certainly chemicals that we do not test for that we should. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I'm certain we're going to we're testing for everything. The challenge is where to put our resources that we have in the ones that we think warrant the most attention. I'll give you an example. I think EPA, it's about 80,000 chemicals are registered, and they're adding, I don't know if it's 1,000 new chemicals a year, but the number of those that are tested are relatively small. And so even at the federal level, we recognize there will not be enough resources to test all those. So the challenge for me and my staff is to try to figure out which chemicals are likely ones that we ought to test for. And so in that respect, we've created a lateral team. And what I mean by lateral is across the agency, looking at these emerging chemicals and contaminants, endocrine disruptors, PFCs, et cetera, to try to pick out where should we start the cutting edge and push harder in terms of research and testing. And as you probably know as well, we're supportive of the bill related to endocrine disruptors because more work is needed there. I don't have a clear answer for you in terms of all knowledge in this area, but I want you to know I think in the future we need more work in this area, and I have a personal interest in doing that as well.
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Moore, I'm going through your resume here, and forgive me if I ask a question that you covered before we came, but I note that you have quite a background, quite a lot of experience. You forgot one item on here, however, and that's as a member of the Capital Chapter of Ducks, for which I have to tell everybody who isn't acquainted with that that he does a whole lot of work on it. He's a good and faithful member of the committee. Sells a lot of tickets.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I apologize. And as a long-lived member of DU, you know, we do need to mention the ducks.
Well,
and,
I know
of course,
that
water quality.
Yes, and you mentioned that you're a lifelong angler.
Thank you for pointing that out. I'll make that correction.
My question, though, has to do with, I don't know if you call them field offices, rural offices, district offices, or regional offices, but how many do you have? And I wonder how legislators, sometimes we get questions from people, and we sometimes don't know where to direct questions. Would you prefer that we direct them to the central office or to whatever your other field offices are? And what would be the appropriate way for us to handle things that we have questions on?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Parasol, either way, if you get a question into myself or Deputy Commissioner Leo Rodiz, if we think it should be handled by a regional office, we'll get it out there right away. Some legislators have very good working relationships. Say, for example, in the agriculture region, the feedlot experts are in our offices in Marshall and Wilmer, for example. And if we get a question, we'll send it out there right away. So whoever you find the easiest route in, it's my responsibility to make sure it gets to the right person and quickly. But our regional offices have good working relationships with legislators, and they're happy to take them as well.
Thank you. That's helpful. I used to enjoy when the state did that nice directory of all the agencies, so we had some ideas where the offices were, who handled what, and didn't have to spend hours pestering somebody in the central office to send it downward or whatever, but we don't see that anymore. I think it got to be too expensive, something, but it was a handy one to have, one at home and one at the office.
Did you want a response to that?
Not necessarily. I just, right. It's just one of the things that I miss a lot, and I think admin found it to be too costly for them. So,
hey, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't know myself. I wonder if that's online in terms of, but I,
could
know,
be,
I,
but
I'll
I'm such a low
that.
Tech person that yeah. I just ask the questions by phone.
Senator Olson, then Ingebrigtsen, Dibble, and Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Moore. I've gotten some inquiries on some potential action federally by Congressman Oberstar that I just learned a detail of it that the EPA, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, has jurisdiction currently over navigable waters, and that there is some effort to lift or to remove the word navigable, which would essentially give them a jurisdiction over all waters, which would be all of our lakes as well. And I wonder what you know about that and where, what your view is on that kind of an initiative. Or takeover, if you will, depending on how.
Mr. Chair, Senator, my understanding is that that initiative relates to the, I believe, I don't know if it was a Court of Appeals or Supreme Court, the Swank decision that relates to protection of wetlands. And as you might recall, the court decision restricted the government's ability to regulate or to protect wetlands that only relates to those wetlands that are linked up to, related to navigable waters. And so the interest in that federal legislation by removing the word navigable gives the agencies more authority with respect to wetland protection. For example, in Minnesota, we have many isolated wetlands that are not linked up with a navigable water. And so the purpose of that is to ensure that, for example, Army Corps of Engineers protection to wetlands. I have not seen the specific language on that bill in terms of, where that authority is coming from, so I can't comment on the specific legislation. I do know that in the past, the Pollution Control Agency, the Board of Water Soil Resources, and DNR, and the governor have been supportive of ensuring the definition is broad enough so that the protection for wetlands extends beyond just those linked to navigable water.
So follow up, Mr. Chairman, I guess my question is, are the states not, are we as a state not adequately or able to protect our wetlands without having the federal government tell us what to do? It seems to me it's a federal encroachment into resources that are uniquely in our state. The navigable waters often connect states, which you could probably see why they would have jurisdiction. Why would we want the federal government to have jurisdiction? Or are you saying that federal jurisdiction is required in order to authorize the states to have it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, Minnesota's fortunate to have a very strong wetlands protection law through the Wetland Conservation Act, and we enjoy a number of protections that other states do not. That said, I'm not familiar with the specifics, but I know it does relate to where the Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, can intervene or be involved in some of the wetland protection efforts. I can get back to you with specifics on that. I don't know the details.
Yeah, thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Moore, I have more of a probably a practical question. Senator Parasol touched on the resources that you bring. I live in and represent West Central Minnesota, where I have a fair amount of large animal operations, 700 units, 1,500 units. And what role would your organization play with the EPA in dealing with complaints from residents of those particular areas? Odor? Mainly odor.
Mr. Chairman,
I have to be very, I'll be very frank with you. I do have an issue that I'm calling your office on now, and I just want to know how the system works. There's been some fines actually levied on this particular place. So what role would you play in that, your office play in that, or versus the EPA? How do you both get in the mix there? How does that happen?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the Pollution Control Agency, with respect to air quality and water quality, the EPA programs are delegated to us. So we actually enforce it at the local level. A couple areas that we get involved in terms of animal agriculture feedlots. One is odors, air, and the other is related to discharges. And we do an NPDES permits related to discharge. Typically when there's a complaint, there are times when we have monitoring equipment, and we'll do actually monitoring of the facility and try to model to find out is a complaint, valid, et cetera, and then working with the producer to figure out means of trying to reduce those complaints. It can be everything from whether they cover the manure lagoons to how they operate their facility. And so there's a variety of activities that we do on the ground with those operators.
Just a short follow-up. So if I have complaints, of course, you've already said that, I can come to you or your office and I think the regional director for that would be maybe up in Detroit Lakes. I don't know. You have a regional office up in Detroit Lakes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we do, and sometimes in those complaints, they do come to me, and we take them pretty seriously. So if you have a problem, let's talk.
On that feedlot issue, does the PCA still delegate its responsibility for regulating small feedlots to counties?
Mr. Chairman, there's 54 counties in the program where we do delegate the regulation to counties. And in doing that, we also, though, do monitoring in terms of follow-up to ensure that the counties are following the rules. And as you might guess, we have some counties that are very strong and do a great job, and others that we need to do more work with. Overall, however, when you consider the amount of money that the legislature has appropriated to this program in grants to the counties, if you look at the situation 10 years ago versus today, we have a lot more dollars going in and much better compliance than the issues that we had 10 years ago. So we have the ability, even in a delegated county, to work with that county to ensure compliance is met. And frankly, compliance is getting better and stronger, but there are a few areas where additional work is needed.
Well, 8 years ago, there was an audit that showed that there were problems with lack of adequate funding to the feedlot office, the county feedlot officers, and that the quantity and quality of inspections, they varied considerably amongst the counties. Would you agree with that sentiment today, or has the situation changed?
Mr. Chairman, I think the situation's changed, and I'll give you an example. The grant dollars available to counties, I don't have the exact number years ago, but it was 8 or 10 years ago, was in the neighborhood of 200 to 300,000. Today it's over 2 million. So in terms of resources for those counties to do that compliance and enforcement. Another thing that that I notice is the number of complaints that I have coming to my office as opposed to my predecessors. And I remember while at DNR, years ago, all the feedlot problems. And there are a few that come in, but they're actually far and few between. And we seem to be able to address them pretty well. And for my part, what I've been doing is, I was out at a large dairy operation about 2 weeks ago, and also a small operation. And so as I'm learning my new job, I'm also trying to get out on the ground to see how it actually works and see where the issues are with the various operators, what they like about what we're doing, what they don't, and trying to get a sense myself of how well it's working. And I'm still in a learning mode on that.
Do you recall what the backlog of feedlot permits is at the moment?
Mr. Chairman, I do not. I will say that one of the programs that was started a few years ago at MPCA is outcomes relative to whether it's feedlot permits, ethanol, industrial air permits, where we are monitoring ourselves in terms of backlogs and permits over the time. And we have goals for every single program to have inspections by a certain date, reduce backlogs, et cetera. And what I can do is provide that information for you to show you how we're doing and where we have an area that's not going well, what we're doing to correct it. So I want this committee to be aware that as an agency, we're taking that outcome-based management very seriously, not only for ourselves, but it's data that's available to all of you. And it's a report card, for lack of better words.
Senator Dibble was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you touched on PFOSs. Keen interest suddenly in PFOS. I was interested before when it was affecting Senator Seaman and her area of the world, but even more so, it's got my attention. Now that we are starting to find these PFCs, these chemicals, in places where they weren't necessarily expected, it doesn't take a whole lot of intuition to understand why they might be showing up in Senator Seaman's area, but now they've shown up in the bluegill of Lake Calhoun, in some of the pools and in the river. It's kind of confounding. I've had some initial conversations with your staff and Department of Health staff, And they've been great, by the way, and I appreciate their very, very proactive work with myself, and they've been great to work with as we contemplate going out to the community to have some more conversation with them in the form of a public meeting in a few weeks. So I commend you and your staff for handling this well, at least from this point. But this clearly has gotten the attention of the public. It's a hot issue. It's a nasty chemical. It's very persistent. It bioaccumulates. It doesn't break down in the environment, and its pathways are a total mystery. And so it seems to me that it's going to take, you know, a lot of time and a lot of money. Hopefully not too much time, but certainly a lot of money, a lot of effort, to really sleuth out exactly why it's ending up in the bluegill in Lake Calhoun and in other places. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what is the plan? How are we going to figure this out? How are we going to figure out what the health consequences are? Where it's coming from, and how to deal with it? And are you going to be? And I guess I'm making an offer as well. Are you going to be coming? Do you need more resources to solve this problem? And I'm guessing that, you know, this is just one of a number of issues like it that will be coming up as we gain more information about different kinds of chemicals and gain more ability to detect those chemicals.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, it is a perplexing problem. Earlier this week, Leo Rodiz, our deputy, and I had sat down and talked with the lateral team, we call it, that deals with perfluorinated compounds. And one of the questions that I asked them is, I need them to go back and determine what resources they think they need in the next several years to do these investigations. So first, I want the committee to know I've asked the question. And secondly, we've asked them to put together a work plan in terms of, all right, what's the next step with the investigations related to the Lake Calhoun and the lakes near there, but then also the other metropolitan lakes that we're going to be sampling. So I don't have a dollar amount yet, and the work plan they're developing right now. But continually, and please ask staff, I've made it very clear that I will get our staff the resources they need to investigate these problems. You know, I think most people have, on average, about 5 parts per billion of PFAS, I think, in our own systems. I mean, it's ubiquitous. And so it's something we have to address. We are very perplexed in terms of where the chemical came from with respect to Calhoun. And that's not a good position to be in. And I know our scientists really want to find out the answer to that. So that's what I can tell you right now.
When you say most of us have that 5 parts per billion, you mean most Minnesotans?
Mr. Chair, yes. And, of course, well, I use the word most because some people might have more, some less. There's variation among people.
Because this is a chemical that was produced exclusively by a Minnesota company. So if you go to South Dakota, they probably don't have PFCs.
No, they do.
No, Mr. Chairman, I think they would. Just like I spent some time up on Hudson Bay a few years ago canoeing, and the polar bears we saw up there actually have them as well. So there's a, they call fate and transport. The mechanisms aren't completely known, but these chemicals of both 3M and DuPont were also manufactured, have circulated worldwide.
Thanks for clarifying. You had a follow-up, Senator Dibble?
Just on this, and then I had a new subject to raise. I recall just sitting with your staff in Senator Chaudhry's office, and you know, the speculation, you know, kind of blue sky speculation: is it atmospheric deposition? There's a rail corridor nearby. Was there a spill at some point? Is there a dump that we don't know about? Were the bluegill stocked? Or is there something going on with how people are using various consumer products in the vicinity of Lake Calhoun? I mean, it's as wide open as that, so you can imagine the kind of investigation that will have to be undertaken to solve this mystery. It's a daunting task. On the subject of another surface water question, and the subject of Lake Superior and the introduction of invasive aquatic species through ballast water as a vector. I understand, I didn't realize this until some advocates shared some information with me, that the EPA thought the NPA PDES pollutant discharge process wasn't valid for ballast water discharge. Apparently that has been overturned by the courts, and in fact ballast water dumped untreated into our surface water can be subject to these MPDES permits, and so we can gain National Pollution Discharge
Elimination Discharge System.
Yeah, so it's like when someone wants to dump something unpleasant into our surface waters, they need to get a permit, and then that regulates how much and where and how often and that sort of thing. I actually learned also that several billion gallons of untreated ballast water is dumped into Lake Superior every year, more than the treated water that comes from the nearby sanitary systems. That was fascinating to me. And so it would seem to me that now we have the ability to gain some ability to manage what's being dumped out of the ballast water into the Great Lakes. And, of course, the big concern is, certainly animals, but we've got, viruses, things that are more traditionally considered pollutants coming in through the ballast water. VHS, the viral hemorrhagic, the Ebola for fish now has made its way into the Great Lakes and might make it into the inland waters. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the MPCA's authority, willingness, ability to try to help us grapple with this ballast water issue in Lake Superior, especially as it relates to something really nasty like VHS that, can go devastate our fish populations.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, it's a frustrating issue because I grew up in Duluth, and so I've watched over the years, the addition of river ruff, spiny water flea, zebra mussels, the goby. Over time, and in my hometown and port, these additional creatures come in. And yet, there's been a lot of inaction at the federal level to do something. Here's where we're at the PCA. I'm working with the Attorney General's Office and the DNR, and at present time, we do not think we have the authority to go on those ships, particularly the foreign ships, and maritime law is different. Now, that being said, there's a couple things to consider. First of all, that's in my work with the Attorney General's Office, and the Attorney General filed an amicus brief related to the EPA lawsuit, so I want this committee to know they, too, are very concerned about this. So in terms of their advising me on my authorities, the advice is from someone who cares a great deal as well. That said, we also think we need a law similar to Michigan in place to actually do the regulation and then MPDES permits. That particular bill has been up a couple sessions, but I don't believe it's had a hearing this year. So one thing that's needed is a statute that's very specifically related to this that we're going to need, and I would support that. In addition to that, the Michigan law, of course, is being challenged. So we're watching very closely, not only us, but the Attorney General's office as well, to find out if Michigan's going to actually be able to implement that. So in terms of first steps, we need language that allows us to do it. And an advantage of having a law similar to Michigan is one of the arguments against us is to say that we have different a patchwork of laws and we're restricting interstate commerce. If we have consistency among the states, at least you have a leg hold in terms of your arguments. Secondly, the agencies have been in contact with the congressional delegation, specifically Congressman Oberstar, and I think he's having a forum in early May with Dr. Gary Glass, who's been a leader up in the Duluth area on this. But we need to continue to push at the federal level so the agencies do rulemaking, and it's between EPA and actually the Coast Guard. So at the state level, there's some things we can do related to language. And also, we have some meetings coming up internally. We just met with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy on this. I want to make sure that our agency's ready, because it's clear at some point we're going to be able to do this. And once we're able to, I don't want to wait another year while we figure out, but rather be ready to go.
Follow-up? Yeah, just a final comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate some of those. I would just encourage you, Mr. Commissioner Moore, that the DNR, in my view, the DNR and I didn't even know the PCA might might have had, you know, some role in this or some ability to take some active role. The state has just been very, very passive when it comes to dealing with the challenges that confront Lake Superior, and kind of wringing their hands and shrugging their shoulders. Oh, well, you know, the feds have to act, and have not been very activist on it, really pushing the envelope, confronting, challenging. At the end of the day, Lake Superior is a part of our state, and it's our surface water, and we have responsibility for it. And we can talk about interstate commerce and international commerce, that's fine. But what gets dumped out in Lake Superior ultimately finds its way into our inland waters, and now we've seen, you know, the devastation that inattention or passivity can have. And so I just encourage you to be, you know, as involved and proactive as you just described, and more so.
Senator Stumpf and then Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a couple of comments and not so much a question. I want to commend you and the agency for your attempts to try to be proactive in the sense of soliciting the key players in addressing certain problems. And obviously, I had a chance to discuss or talk with you about some of the ethanol issues. And I think going back, and I believe it was under Governor Arne Carlson, there was an attempt to try to redo how the MPCA would address environmental issues. And at that time, the purpose was more to bring in corporate America into the loop ahead of or along with addressing the problem versus the agency being an enforcement arm primarily, and then we have to try to somehow force the whether it's a cleanup issue or whether it's some kind of a remediation or whatever. And I personally think that, and especially as you talk about the numerous chemicals that are coming online, the numerous problems that we currently have, it seems to me that the more you can be proactive in bringing those entities on board and making them feel that they have a role in solving the problem, the better we'll be able to address the solution. Enforcement is definitely an important component, but I don't think the end solution, if you're only enforcement or agency's role is enforcement, I think the end solution will be much harder to come by. And I commend your agency for another reason, is that last summer we had some ground surface water that was polluted by a concrete company, and so the concrete company calls and says, you know, MPCA's gonna or doing some action are gonna come out. So I said, fine, I'll go out there and be there, and if nothing else, I'll be in support, you know, of listening. And so we went out there, and I was very impressed with the agency's approach. The agency's approach was not to necessarily to slap a huge fine, but they said, here's what we want you to do in terms of cleaning up what you did, but instead of a fine, we would like you to work with other concrete companies, maybe put a class on or sponsor some kind of a effort to raise the educational level of all concrete companies in the area that you're not supposed to be doing this, basically dumping some tailings or leftover concrete. So I thought that was very impressive, and I think that type of approach not only gives state government a better name and in terms of dealing with the public, but I think the end solution would be less expensive, and I think we get a whole lot further along by doing that. And so I want you to hopefully continue to do that. The other issue is more, I think, a county issue, but, you know, we have this deal with wastewater and wastewater treatment, and we've got it at all levels, whether it's municipalities or whether it's individual septic systems or whatever. To me, the issue is huge, but it's a very important one when we talk about clean water. The way I would approach it would be go after the worst culprits first. And when I use this example, so I hope I'm not repeating myself, but we've got numerous straight pipes going into our lakes and rivers and things. Those are the ones that we ought to get onto right away to try to eliminate. And then go to the next tier of problems. I think that would help, and I know it's a county issue, and some of it's an enforcement issue, and some of it's a financial issue, but I think try to get at the worst problem first and then move up the ladder. It would be a suggestion. But thank you for taking a positive, proactive approach.
That's a good point that Senator Stuff makes. First of all, that you were to be commended, that's a good point. But also, who are the worst polluters in Minnesota? Is it the straight pipes? Is it the energy companies? Is it, we're learning more and more, is it the straight pipes? We're learning more and more about non-point source pollution coming from just kind of the general, what runs off the land and into the water system. Who are the worst polluters, and how is the PCA dealing with non-point source solution? That seems to, I mean, you can turn on, that seems to be the more complicated, the harder issue to deal with. I mean, you can say, well, we need less emissions. We can ban straight pipes. We can, we can reduce discharge, and that kind of becomes, you know, a political question almost. But how do you deal with this growing source of pollution that kind of comes from everywhere?
Mr. Chairman, I'll preface the comments with what's interesting about the agency's work is when you look at where pollution comes from, it's so much of it, of course, depends on the pollutant. So, for example, and I'll get to answering your question directly, for sulfur dioxide, you first go to the utilities, you know, Xcel Energy, but, of course, Xcel Energy supplies power to so many homes. And then you look at, for example, on mercury reduction, you move to a different industry such as taconite and utilities. You move into transportation sector for other kinds of pollutants, nitrogen oxide. So depending where you are, it can be a different one. But with respect to non-point, it is perhaps our most challenging problem ahead of us because we're pretty good at regulating out of a point source. It becomes a matter of economics and technology. And if you have the technology to do it, you plug in the economic question of whether the company can do it and compete. But non-point's a lot tougher. So that when you look at the largest where it's coming from for non-point, you both run into both urban centers, really major sources in terms of runoff from our streets, people's homes, the roofs into the lakes. And so that's a big area that we're addressing through various activities on regulation. And then, of course, non-point runoff relating to the rural sector and, for example, in agriculture and the need to do more with respect to BMPs, with respect to phosphorus, fecal coliform. So those are big areas, and I think what I'd say is it's both an urban, suburban, and a rural problem. Oftentimes I'll have I'll sit with the agricultural community and they'll say, well, what are they doing in the urban areas? There's a lot there. And the agricultural community is correct. And similarly, I'll sit down with suburban folks to say, look, isn't this an ag problem? and I'll say there are problems there. So, and what's key in all of this in terms of addressing the issue is engaging the local folks, the citizenry, the local producers and others. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that I face as head of an environmental agency is how do we get our citizens, our youth, engaged to care about the environment? And so another priority I have is how do we step up the citizen involvement, citizen literacy in terms of environmental matters so that they care and actually get engaged? Because I was listening to someone the other day talking about there was an agricultural runoff problem, and the person doing the monitoring was the daughter of an agricultural producer. That individual listened a lot more because it was his own daughter that had the monitoring data than were I to come in and say, hey, here's the problem. Because your own family or your own neighbor or community, there's a way of addressing that you can do it that a statewide regulator can't. So it's from all these different sources. We have to tailor the programs to them and actively engage it locally.
Mr. Saxhawk, then I've got Siebe and then Fredrickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I've had privilege of working with you in the DNR for many years, and that's been a good experience. And most recently, in your present position, working with your agency on air permitting for Minnesota Steel. We aren't done with it yet, but the process has been very good, and I appreciate that. And you've always been a good educator and a good communicator, and always got a straight answer out of you, which is always important. Now I have a mundane question for you. You know, two days ago we had Commissioner Holston tell us that he was going to lose 49% of his agency in, what do you say, 10 years? And I'm assuming, and I know Bowser gave us about the same answer, and I'm interested in your answer. I'm assuming it's relatively close to that, but this isn't something that's just been happening right along. I mean, it is the post, it's the baby boomers leaving, and you can't just go out and hire a bunch more people. Do you have any answers to what's going to happen in the next 10 years instead of in personnel? Are we going to slim down? Are we going to be able to hire the same quality people, or what's happening?
Commissioner Moore.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxhawk, I think it's one of the fundamental issues facing state government in terms of how we're going to be able to provide services 10 years from now and 15 years from now. We do have similar numbers in terms of quite a number of our staff will be eligible to retire in 5 and 10 years. And a couple of things. First of all, what we're doing about it, that you have some of my staff here, but they tell you, I constantly tell them, if you see good talent and they have any interest in coming here, get them. And because of retirements, whatever, I have a constant, I'm like roving, looking for people that are good. And I just drill that into people's heads. We need good people. And because of the retirements going on, we've got to bring them in. So that's first of all. And you've seen that, for example, we have a very talented person in mining, Ann Foss. Yep. Ann won't be there forever. So when I came on board, I said, Ann, I want someone that you start training in, so that when you leave, we have at least one other person. And, of course, she hired Jess Richards, who's doing a good job. So, first of all, I want you to know I'm very actively cognizant of when I leave this agency, hopefully a number of years from now, not soon, that one of the legacies will be a good, solid senior management team, middle management, and staff. The other thing we're doing is we're looking at contracting where we're able to do that. Example is we can't keep stack testers in terms of emission testing, partly because it's kind of a tedious job, but also that the private sector sees them and snaps them up. So we're starting to look at, is there areas that we can contract? And that's another thing. Another issue that I think is going to have to be addressed is compensation. We are not competing with counties. We are not competing with the private sector, consultants, and others. And while it's good to be a training ground, there's nothing wrong with that, we do need a level of core competence. And that's an issue I know that Commissioner Pat Anderson is very interested in from Doerr. She and I have discussed this, but I would recommend that that this committee and others keep an eye on that as well, because the youth of today, youth would be in their 30s, and those are they're much more flexible. There aren't as many in the baby, the pulse baby boom generations, and they have more choices. And we just lost our communications director, for example, to the federal government, and I think his pay increase was about $10,000, and that's a real issue. So between the issues of compensation, being more efficient with our resources in terms of contracting, looking for automation where you can do it, consulting contracts as well, and then hiring the best. That's the strategy that we're employing here. And by the way, in terms of, you know, whether it be more people or less, our former commissioner, Cheryl Corrigan, worked hard on efficiency measures for the agency using Six Sigma processes. I'm continuing that because she did some great work there. And trying to figure out how can we be more efficient in permitting or in various aspects of regulation. So instead of seven people doing it, can we do it with six? Be accountable and hold the high standards. But you've touched on a topic that is a seminal issue for state government. I hope that helps give you a sense that I'm engaged in it and trying to do something.
Well, kind of along those same lines, and this applies to other departments as well, how do we make sure that staff, particularly in this area where it's so kind of scientific based, how can we make sure that staff can do their jobs with integrity and not having to feel pressured by special interests?
I think that trying, Mr. Chairman, to do that, it starts really here with me in terms of leadership at the top and creating an environment where staff know they can do their job. And I'll give you a recent example. There's an issue related to capping a disposal site at the 3M Chemolite plant. And we have a couple staff members that disagree on how to do it. And interestingly, the disagreement, they come from different parts of the agency. And as a consequence, some of their training is different. So their perspective is different. And what's important for me in terms of a leader and my leadership team is to make sure that they're free enough to express their opinions and to do their science. So, for example, in this case, what the deputy commissioner and I did is several things. First of all, individually, we brought them in to tell us why they thought what they did. So I listened to the various perspectives, and Leo did. And not quizzed them in terms of why you're doing this, but just tell us what you think. And then in addition to that, we actually went out and visited the sites. I want to see for ourselves. There's nothing like being on site. And then let the staff know and the broader team that disagreement's okay and your personal views, but ultimately I'll have to make a decision on it. And then in this particular case, because science is often fraught with different opinions, look at global climate change about different scientific opinion, we're looking at a third party as well to come in and say, what do you think? As a way for the public to understand that I'm open to other views in terms of third party coming in there and saying, well, what do you think? And this the agency used before in the past as well. There was a dispute among citizens related to the Highway 96 dump site, whether the remediation proposal that we had proposed was good or not. They brought a third party in, and the third party said, yeah, the PCA, what we've planned is good. And so that's an example of where I want to create an environment where people feel they can do their science and their work, have disagreement in a respectful way, and that as a decision maker, I have to weigh that in a manner where I'm not arbitrary or capricious, to use the court standard. And I think that kind of example permeates around the agency, and they recognize it's an open environment that way. And I think you'll see me do that in other examples in the future as well, because that's how I like to do business.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Moore, to build on what you just said, I'd just like to thank you for your work so far this year, and I want the committee members to know that means a lot to come from me, because I've been so critical of the PCA and the previous leadership of the commissioner of the PCA, and I don't expect you to comment on that. But as our community struggles with this PFC contamination, there really is a night and day difference between the previous commissioner of the agency and your leadership of the agency thus far. And I don't really mean mean to be critical of the past commissioner, although I am, but I'm just saying that because your leadership, Commissioner Moore, has really done a lot for me, and I've shared this with my constituents, to rebuild mistrust that our community had with the Pollution Control Agency. And, you know, the committee, we sort of talked about this briefly on the bill that I didn't advance, but just to update the committee on the actions that the PCA is undertaking next Tuesday, Commissioner Moore chairs the Citizens Advisory Board at the PCA, and he's going before the board to recommend to the board that they that the board adopt a position that they would like a request for a response action or a RFRA with 3M for specific three sites where there's been PFC contamination. And this is very important for my community and other parts of the state that were contaminated with PFOA and PFOS, because it's essentially saying that as a state agency, first, we feel that these chemicals are hazardous, and second, that the agency can take the position of telling the company what remediation needs to be done instead of just entering into consent orders where 3M and the agency come to an agreement of what could be done. So I really want to thank you for your leadership on this issue, Commissioner Moore, and say that I am confident in your ability to stick by that decision and encourage the board to come to the same conclusion that you have come to. And this isn't the end of the issue for my area or certainly for the whole state, as we're coming to find that there's more pollution around the state. But I also want the committee to know that, and I wish Senator Stumpf was here to hear this, but with regard to the three sites where PFCs were produced and then dumped, which led to the contamination, in 1985, and this is part of the PCA's statement that's going to be before the board next Tuesday, in 1985, a RFRA, and Commissioner, you can correct me if I mischaracterize this, of course, but a RFRA was entered into, or a consent order was entered into, where 3M was asked to tell the agency if there were any VOCs, or I don't know if they specifically asked for PFCs, but I guess what I'm saying here is that the company had the opportunity in 1985 to disclose to the state of Minnesota that there were PFCs on these sites that they knew about because they're already testing their employees for. They possibly knew that there were some potential health hazards and didn't tell the state. So, and I want to point that out because although I've been very critical of the PCA, I also think that there is some responsibility on behalf of 3M that why I'm so supportive of this new position that the board is taking. It's important for the state, yes, to encourage industry to work with them to remediate pollution, but it's also important for the state when industry has not been responsible to take appropriate action to protect public health, but also taxpayers' dollars for how the remediation is going to be cleaned up. So I guess I don't really have a question for you, Commissioner Moore. Just, again, to thank you for taking the leadership position that you did. And I'm sure we'll have many opportunities to work on this issue in the future. But just to publicly commend you for your leadership.
Thank you.
I share some cautious optimism on that issue, too. Particularly the way Commissioner has worked on this issue. Having said that, the Citizens Board has not ratified the decision on the hazardous substances yet. And the 3M has indicated that they disagree
with the hazardous substance labeling. So in my attorney's mind, that spells lawsuit.
Mr. Chair.
And not necessarily resolution.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you, and certainly this will be an ongoing issue, but I think the fact that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is now stating that PFCs are hazardous substances and making those recommendations, and like Mr. Knopf has already explained to me before, you know, once the commissioner makes this decision or the board makes this determination, it's not challengeable in a court of law, or it's not challengeable.
And that, in terms that, of that's a recent AG opinion that's been issued. Is that correct?
You mean whether how the PFCs
that the
are
board's
hazardous.
Decision is not challengeable?
Mr.
Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, I got a Mr. Schirkenbach was here. I think when Senator's bill was up previously, had mentioned that it was that it could be challenged in the courts, but I received a subsequent email from Mr. Schirkenbach, and I don't remember who was all on the email list, that said that they had an opinion from the Attorney General's office that under federal law that this decision as to whether it's a hazardous waste, and I don't pretend to completely understand all the details of it, was not subject to challenge. I may have saved the email, but it was an email from Mr. Schirkenbach wanted it basically correcting what he had said in front of the committee before. I don't know if Commissioner Moore is familiar with that or if there are other staff here that are, but you may want to.
Well, I guess we could ask the Attorney General's office. On the board, four of the board members are also up for confirmation before the Senate this year for a four-year term. 2 months ago, I sent a letter to them encouraging them, although it's not required, encouraging them to touch base at the very least with the members of the committee that would be hearing their confirmation. Since then, I have not heard one word from any of the members of the board. Commissioner, does the Citizens Board take their role with the PCA seriously?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do believe they do take their role seriously. Perhaps what needs to happen is I need to do a better job of explaining to them confirmation process and the importance of the Senate oversight in this matter. For someone like me who's been in state government many years in commissioner's office, I understand your role quite well and have a deep respect for it. It perhaps is that they need some help from me to also understand that, and I'm willing to do that.
And then on the board.
Mr. Chairman, did you copy Commissioner Moore with those letters?
Commissioner Moore received a letter of his own.
But is he aware that you sent the letters to the? Was he aware of the letters that you sent to his board members?
I'm not sure. Were you aware that I sent a letter to the board members? I sent the same letter to everyone who was up for confirmation or committee.
Mr. Chairman, if I didn't receive the letter, I knew you were going to do it. So I was aware of it. Now, whether I got copies of it or not, I don't remember, but I know quite well the chairman had discussed the fact he was going to do this, send those letters.
And to clarify, Senator Olson, I'm not implying that Commissioner Moore has a responsibility in that matter. I'm just asking the question if he knows about how serious the board members take their role, particularly when they are to be confirmed by the Senate. On the board membership, does the environmental community have a designee on the Citizens Board?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no. The designations relate to a member of labor And the other designation relates to someone from the agricultural community. And then the law statute also indicates not more than two members can be employed by a municipality. The other constraints, of course, is if you're a holder of a NPDES permit, a regulated party, for example, you're not on the board. And so it's fairly restricted that way as well. But with respect to environmental community representative, no, not under current statute.
Senator Fredrickson, thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chairman, I had a couple areas I wanted to talk a little bit about, and part question and part statement. But Commissioner, I've known you for many, many, many years, of course, when you worked at the Department of Natural Resources. And I know you follow a style of collaboration and talking with stakeholders and scientists and staff, and I certainly agree with that. And you try to arrive at decisions from consensus and get agreement from all the parties. And that's good, but you're also in a position now where you have an enforcement role. You know, so you have the carrot of the collaboration and cooperation to come to a decision, but at some point there we do have bad actors in the environment. At some point you have to come to an enforcement action at times, sort of a stick. And I'm curious how you decide when you're gonna move to that enforcement mode. If you've thought through that or have an idea of when you say, okay, we've tried working this out, we've tried to come to consent agreements or compliance agreements, you know, we're through doing that now, we're going to move over into more of the enforcement mode.
Commissioner,
do you have any comments on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, I'd say that's one of the areas that in the agency where I'm doing a lot of learning right now, and I can tell you my experiences so far. The way enforcement is handled with respect to monetary penalties, these kinds of things in the agency, is it's thoroughly discussed among a team of individuals and an enforcement forum, as it were. And so it gets debated out among the staff in terms of the appropriate kinds of fines or compliance. Then typically what's happened to date in terms of what's come to my desk is oftentimes a regulated party, they might not like a particular fine against them, and they'll request a contested case hearing. And in the contested case hearing, the administrative law judge then issues a ruling whether they think the agency was appropriate or not as a recommendation to me. And what's been interesting about those that have come to me today, and there haven't been that many, is in every single case, the administrative law judge has upheld the agency staff in terms of a recommendation to me. I haven't had one yet where the judge has said that we have been too prescriptive or onerous in our enforcement. And that either tells you that all the judges are working with the agency or the fact that that the staff have been pretty reasonable. And so at least in the contested case ones where the regulated party does not think we're right, the few that have come to me through a lot of documentation, I mean, some of these files are very thick, they've said that, no, we're on the right track. And I have signed those, so I'm not afraid of enforcing. That said, what I've told staff as recently as last week, there was an enforcement seminar that staff were at, is that I'll back them on enforcement, but they have to do a really good job in terms of documentation to make sure they are being fair, because anytime you bring the police powers of the state to bear upon a citizen, you really have to make sure your ducks are in order and that it is the appropriate solution. And I think they heard me on that in terms of I will back them, but I want to make sure that they've really done their homework and that it's reasonable and there's ample evidence. So that's the message I gave to our staff. I'm still waiting through it because it's different than DNR enforcement. The penalties, as you know, can be quite high, hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases. Most are much smaller. So I'm still trying to figure that out. Does that give you a sense at least where I'm at right now?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, it does, and I'm glad to hear you say what you said, because I certainly believe in cooperation and collaboration and working out mutual agreements too. But there's got to be a time where patience runs out and where somebody's violating our laws or doing harm to an environment where we're not afraid to be we don't want to be timid. We, you know, there's a time where we want to become aggressive, too, to stop the bad actors, you know. So.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator, I recognize that, and I think you'll see me. I have done that already, okay. And I think you'll see me continue that more appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just kind of think out loud a little bit about an issue that Senator Stump raised. He talked about going after the worst first and talk about going after straight pipes from septic systems, our sewer system first. And a couple questions came to my mind. How do you define the worst? You know, which ones do you go after first? Is it the single home that has a straight pipe and it's the virulence of the discharge that you're going after? Even though they may discharge only a small amount of effluent each day, or do you go after a small city that has a wastewater treatment system, but it's failing and they're discharging hundreds of thousands of gallons of water and not all that virulent? Do you go after the virulence of the discharge or the quantity of the discharge? Which do you do first? And, you know, where does the quality of the water body that's receiving that discharge, and what is the intended use of that water? Is that one of the factors in deciding which is the worst and which one you go after first? You know, is it the pathogens in a small discharge, or is it a large quantity of not as virulent a discharge, or is it the water quality? And I think, at least in my mind, that's one of the things we struggle with which is the worst that we go after first, and, you know, where does the dollars available for addressing those come in?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, you know, you stumped me on the question. I have an answer, but I don't know how our staff do that. And I will find out, because I want to know myself. That said, a couple factors do come into play. For example, we had a situation on the Rainy River where there was a failing, small operation of a failing lift system, and there was a direct discharge going into the Rainy. We moved quickly on that and had very stringent enforcement. The Rainy is a really important river with respect to its fishery. And so I want to let you know that in terms of staff members, they recognize there's a difference in quality in terms of water bodies. So that's an example where I made it clear to staff that I don't want that discharge in that river. It needs to stop. That said, though, I'll have to find out a little bit more because I don't know, to be frank.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Moore, we've heard testimony in a couple committees this session so far that has talked about economic development, especially in rural Minnesota, that may have been hampered by the permitting process and the speed of that permitting process. Do you see ways that we can speed that up, especially in projects that are very similar in nature, without harming the integrity of the process?
I can remember the
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I've three thoughts on that to provide to you. First of all, in terms of the agency's role in permitting, there are areas that we can speed up and improve. We know that, and in fact, we've done that. We've already begun that road, particularly with respect to ethanol permitting. We can show you where the time frame has shrunk. And what we're doing to continue to improve that process is this spring, probably in June or July, it's a Kaizen process improvement effort that the state of Iowa has used in permitting. We're going to run our staff through that in terms of trying to get more efficiencies. So we play a role in terms of efficiency as well. And I want you to know our staff are very cognizant of always trying to look for a better way to do it. Secondly, there's a role that the project proposers play as well. On some of these projects, and I just want you to be aware of it, they get slowed up because the project proposals don't have all the data in them or have, in some cases, the wrong data. And we've run into this everything from ethanol plants and, as Senator Saxhog knows, to much larger operations or proposed operations in northern Minnesota. And so when the project proposal comes in, we might spend weeks or months getting that proposal ready so that it can actually be permitted. On some occasions, those project proposers say, well, look, it took us an extra 3 months. And why I will gladly take responsibility for our share when it slows down, and sometimes it is. There are times when the consultant doesn't do a good job or the project proposer. Lastly, the third leg of the stool, as it were, our environmental review processes are different than in other states. And right now we're working on a study to compare those processes with other environmental review processes with comparable states. That study is going to be out this late summer or fall. I know Senator Scoe, he's been very interested in this, and others, where we can take a look at the actions of what's going on in other parts of the U.S. and ours, and look for areas where ours could be improved or changed. And so I think between internal improvements, working with those consultants to, you know, for them, and then also the statewide process, I think we can do make some improvement. So that's the three that I'm looking at.
Thank you. On the agency's mission, it's my understanding that at one time the mission of the PCA stated that the PCA is to reduce the amount of pollution that is emitted in the state. And now the mission is to work with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. Is this the current mission statement?
Mr. Chairman, yes. But within that mission statement are very specific goals towards reduction of pollution in all the air, water, and land medium, with benchmarks for each one.
Thank you. Just a couple more questions from my end. On methamphetamines, what has changed within the PCA to address this kind of rash of meth labs and cleanups around the state?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. I will have to get back to you on that.
Okay. And then the last question, I guess the topic I would touch on is on mining. How are we dealing with, you touched on it earlier on some of the air emissions. How about some of the groundwater issues that surround mining? What is the current status of some of the mining projects and the permitting and potential groundwater discharge?
Mr. Chairman, I can give you just a thumbnail sketch on a couple of these. For example, in the Minnesota Steel Project, because it's in the Mississippi River Lake Pepin Basin, they're looking at a zero discharge of water.
Which project?
Minnesota Steel, okay. Mr. Chairman. In terms of water appropriation, they're looking at one of the mine pits to take water from that has an ample supply of water. For the appropriation level of water, of course, that's a DNR permit. Water quality is ours. In terms of anything related to water quality, when an EAW, and in these cases, they're all EISs, when it's done, that water quality aspect has to be taken care of. A bigger challenge, or a large challenge related to groundwater and water in general with some of the mines, is seepage from the tailings ponds affecting downstream water quality. There's issues related at North Shore Mining with respect to fluorine in the Beaver River. There are issues with respect to MNTAC and discharges that relate to tributaries of the Vermilion River. And those are ongoing actions that we're working to try to solve how to reduce that filtration of water through the earth into other bodies of water. And they're very hard to deal with because the size of these tailing basins are quite large. I mean, they're giant. And it's a perplexing problem to deal with. We know at the proposed Polymet mine, One of the issues that's going to be looked at in the EIS is whether the tailings basin will be lined or not, and that relates directly to discharge into groundwater, to other surface water, and you can imagine we have some strong views on that. So the bottom line is that with respect to those tailings ponds, we have issues ongoing now that we're trying to address, and in future projects, the environmental impact statements are very rigorous with respect to ensuring that issue is addressed. And the citizenry takes a pretty close look at that as well.
Senator Sieben, then Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Moore, I have a quick, well, I'll try to keep it brief, but what, and we talked about this earlier this year, but what commitment do you have to work with other agencies to respond to potential chemical releases or releases of hazardous substances as a result of fires, for example? I know we talked about there was a fire in South St. Paul early this summer at an epoxy plant, and a ton of my front yard, we couldn't see across the street because there was this cloud of, we didn't know what it was. And the local fire department wasn't in South St. Paul, was in charge of trying to determine what was in the air, and they didn't really know. And I'm just curious if you have any update on how the MPCA can work with the Department of Public Safety and the health department in when it comes to kind of disaster response issues.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, the conversation that we had on that has started a number of conversations internally. Steve Lee, who's our chief emergency response lead, thinks that that area is one where we are potentially very weak. And so we've asked him to begin working on what are the resources and various work that we need to improve this area, and they're currently working on that. I think at the present time, as you know, the local emergency responders are the ones in charge, but the role that we play, and importantly, the knowledge of what's at those facilities, that's what needs to get stronger so that we know what's in those particular facilities. It's not where it should be yet. We plan to have a number more conversations with you in terms of direction. We're going to hit on that, and potentially, you know, some work at the next legislative session.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I just encourage you to keep in touch with all of us so that also the agency can ask for appropriate money that's needed to ensure that there is a proper response or the ability to respond.
Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair, when appropriate, I would move the nomination of Brad Moore as Commissioner of the MPCA, that it be approved and sent to the floor with a recommendation for approval.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner, I guess there was one more question. Is Minnesota on the verge of not meeting federal air quality standards and of being in violation of the Clean Air Act, especially with regards to particulate matter and ozone? And if so, what are we doing about it?
Mr. Chairman, with respect to particulate matter, we are getting near the limit where we could violate federal air quality standards. And the issue there is that the standards have been getting tighter. So on one hand, our air is cleaner than it used to be, but as science moves along, we find we need cleaner air in order to be healthy. One of the projects that we're doing is a budget initiative related to green fleets. So that's, for example, retrofitting school buses. These are the kinds of projects that we're working very proactively with regulated parties to do. So this is one example. We're very engaged in this with the Minnesota Environmental Initiative. And you might want to, the other thing to point out is the Chamber of Commerce, Flint Hills Resources, the industry is very interested as well in staying ahead of this game, because once you move out of attainment of federal air quality standards, it also moves in a whole bunch of other regulations. And so it's better, of course, to stay clean, first of all, for our health, but also is in terms of the regulatory environment. And so this is just one example of David Thornton, our assistant commissioner responsible for air. We've said, you know, go forth, and this is an area that we got to move ahead. particulate matter as well relates to some of the renewable energies, the recent legislation as well. So across the board, I think we're moving forward on this. But you are right on that it's a concern.
If there aren't any other questions, Commissioner, do you have any final comments?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the time and the questions, which not only I but my staff have written them down in terms of it's always good to keep a focus in terms of what is of interest to you. And if you see something going the wrong way, I know you're not shy, but do let me know because I very much value the legislature as our board of directors and want to do a good job, not only for the citizens, but for you. Well, thank you.
Thank you for sticking with us and for answering questions in a specific but also and direct manner. I know that the members appreciate your candor, and I certainly feel comfortable recommending you for confirmation. So with that, Senator Saxog moves to send the appointment of Brad Moore as Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to the floor with a recommendation of confirmation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Look forward to working with you. With that, members, the committee is adjourned.